afternoon. For those of you that I have not met, my name is Cheryl Lloyd, and I work here in the Office of the President and Office of Risk Services. And another fun hat that I have is I chair the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women for this particular office. And it is a fabulous committee with a lot of invigorating folks who want to do good work for you guys here at the Office of the President. And one of our really fun things that we've been doing is having the Women We Admire series talk. And today, we of course have another one. We've been doing this since 2009. And we ask women to come from around the UC system and share their insights about their careers, their workplace challenges, and work-life balance. And we take notes and see what we can learn from that. So without further ado, I'm going to pass the mic over to the chair of the committee. We have a committee that goes out and finds the right speakers, and I'm going to turn this over to Lena, and she will introduce today's speaker. This is our first session in this particular room, so we're very excited about that. And another thing, this session is recorded. So for those who are dialing in, they get to hear us, but also if people want to come back later and revisit and listen to this talk, it is recorded on ReadyTalk and will be loaded onto our website. Lena?
Thank you, Cheryl. Well, welcome, everyone. If you don't have a handout for today, they're up here. If you need one, raise your hand. I think I've got one back there. I'll come around. Just let me know. Also, there are little white pieces of paper for you to enter a drawing. We'll be raffling off two bouquets of flowers after at the end of the session. And I'd like to welcome you all again and to introduce Barbara Allen Diaz, and thank you very much, Barbara, for coming today. Barbara is the system-wide vice president for ANR, Agriculture and Natural Resources, which is a statewide research and public service organization responsible for activities in ag, agriculture, natural resources, environmental sciences, family and consumer sciences, forestry, human and community development, 4-H, youth development, and lots of other areas. In ANR, Barbara has also served as Associate Vice President for Academic Programs and Strategic Initiatives since 2009, and as Assistant Vice President for Programs from 2007 to 2009. She's currently on leave from her position as a tenured faculty member in the College of Natural Resources on the Berkeley campus, where she has worked since 1986. She holds the prestigious Russell Ristucci Chair in Rangeland Management and is really an internationally known resource and expert in the areas of climate change, on rangeland species, and landscape. So hopefully we'll be learning a little bit more about that today. Barbara holds all of her degrees from UC Berkeley. She holds a BA in anthropology, an MS in range management, and a PhD in wildland resource sciences. And we'd like to welcome her today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lauren, Lynn, and Cheryl. I really appreciate it. And appreciate the opportunity. So I didn't know the room was set up this way. I purposely took off my slacks and high heels this morning and put my jeans and cowboy boots on for those of you who have seen me in the elevator and would like to buy your own pair of cowboy boots. These are 30 years old and have just been resold. So they last a long time and they're like wearing slippers. So any of you that want to take advantage of that. It's pretty fun. And of course, down here at OP, coming from the campus, and I'm a field ecologist. So I spend a lot of time in the field, hiking up and down the hills, looking at plants. And coming in here to OP reminded me of when I was 30 years old and first started working for the Forest Service at a graduate school. And went to the city every day with my tennis shoes in my bag and the high heels, you know. I mean, tennis shoes on my feet and high heels in my bag. Got to work, you know, all in my suits and all that stuff. What a change, you know. going to Berkeley and then coming here. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time today. I am really honored to be you. I'm sure that you all have many, many experiences that might be similar to mine, might be different, that you could share with this group. I, like maybe quite a few of you in the room, grew up during the 60s. Well, earlier than that. I went to high school during the 60s, during the time when many of us in the early, late 60s, early 70s thought that we wanted to do something that was going to save the world. That we really, you know, as a group, I, like many of my colleagues, searched for where was that I should be in order that I could make an impact and save the world. And so I, like many others, knew from the beginning, I was raised in a family that said I could be anything I wanted to be, do anything I wanted to do, as long as I worked hard enough. I got to tell you, working on those ballerina steps in my basement for a year, it was clearly apparent that that was not true. I never wanted to become a ballerina, no matter how hard I worked. But more on that kind of stuff later. So, there have been a number of principles that have helped, well, that have formed and has helped me as I've gone from that high school, go to college, be pre-med, realize I was going to be a medical doctor, and what was I doing in pre-med, to studying human evolution in physical anthropology with a double degree in biology, studying ecology so that somehow I could combine these things and help save the world. Okay? From there, I was at the University of Washington. All but 156 of the 180 units that you need to graduate. And I came to Berkeley because at that time I was married to a person that was a year ahead of me in school that started graduate school at Berkeley. So being young, 20 years old, I transferred from University of Washington with 156 units to Berkeley, and they admitted me, but as I soon found out, I was required to take freshman English with a 4.0 grade point average from University of Washington with a double degree in physical anthropology and biology, and I was told that I had to take freshman English as the English requirement at Berkeley, and I could take one of these two courses, or I could leave. And by the way, the dean said, we will never admit a student like you again because you're going to have a Berkeley degree and you're only going to have 24 credits from Berkeley. And so that was my first lesson in, wow, okay. I didn't realize that we were so, it was so important in this situation. But one of the things I learned along the way that is sticking to your core values. And for me, that means as I've come up through the organization, I'm going to go backwards and forward in time here as I tell you some stories that may be of interest or may be of use to you in your professional life or otherwise. But and one of those core values is I've tried all the way through my career to not play favorites. Now, that has both positive and negative consequences. Because much of this system is built on relationships, right? And relationships often come with understanding them that how you get things done is done through people. But for me, there's playing favorite has a corollary to that. So if you don't play favorite, that means you treat everybody with equal respect. And you treat them in ways then that allow people to have equal access to you at some level. But the flip side is, if you don't make relationships that have or gather people around you that have the same kind of goals and objectives, so if you don't get people on the bus with you, then you can't possibly make any kind of positive change. So there's both a don't play favorite, be fair to people. And the flip side is you also have to be able to trust people and have the people you trust on the bus. So that's always been a tension then throughout my career to make sure that I am open and fair and at the same time work on relationships so you can actually get things done. So that's also resulted, though, in the don't play favorites or stick to your core values, has resulted in more than one time in my life, in my career, that I've had to step away from or step down from a position that I've held because I didn't agree with the playing favorites or rewarding people under the table or cutting deals or whatever it is that you want to call it. And I couldn't make any change in that. So for me, it meant I had to step away and I had to step down from those positions. So you got to decide, you know, what the environment is that you want to work in. At least for me, that's what I have to do in my career. And that has some consequences. Okay? I also think that along with this, sticking to core values, is being inclusive. And by that I mean that we need to respect every person in the organization and their role and responsibility that they bring to the organization. So that means everyone has a role, and if they're doing their role and playing in their work, doing their role, they're bringing value out into the organization. So, as you can imagine, I, as a faculty member, have colleagues who actually I genuinely believe they think that faculty are at the top rung of the ladder, that they're the most important thing in the university organization. And if you're a faculty member, you're at the top rung of the pyramid, and everybody else is extraneous at best. Useful if they're helping you out as a faculty member. But other than that, you know, that's been my experience, and one that I've fought against from the very beginning. And I genuinely believe that this great university could not operate if we didn't have all the different kinds of people doing their work, and that's from whether they're file clerks to whether they're administrators to whether they're students, TAs, to whether they're working in maintaining the grounds on the campus. All of us have an incredible value to bring to the university as a whole that makes it operate and makes it as successful as it is. So that's one of my core principles and one that I try to live by. I think, too, that the next point that I'd like to make is that we all have to make choices, and then you have to be okay with the choices you make. So it's a two-sided sword. Me, my first husband and I did not survive graduate school. Okay, so that was the second lesson about you can be anything you want to be and do anything you want to do, but if your husband decides he's leaving, then there's nothing you can do about it, right? So that was another lesson that I learned a long time ago. And at the time, traumatic. But, of course, you know, life works in various ways. And that worked out absolutely for the better. But I always wanted to have children. Okay? So for me, it was important to have a family. And that's not true with everybody, but for me, it was an important part. So I married a man who was 11 years, still is, 11 years older than me. And he was at a place in his career and in his life that the jealousy business wasn't occurring, like in my previous relationship, where I had a great time in graduate school and my spouse had an awful time in graduate school. So, on the other hand, that meant in us choosing each other, my current husband, he, being 11 years older than me, he had his first child when he was 19. I had my first child with him, luckily, when I was 40. And so that meant our kids were 30 years apart in age, and we had 6 grandchildren and a daughter. Okay? The choices for that for me in terms of career were I had just finished my intergovernmental panel on climate change work. I had been spending the less than 2.5 years, including the last 9 months of pregnancy, working with the IPCC, traveling all over the world, becoming internationally known in rangeland ecology and management and climate change issues. As soon as I was done with the IPCC, I was offered an appointment at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab in conjunction with my faculty appointment at Berkeley, and which I accepted. I mean, great honor, work in climate change, continue to do the work I had started in the IPCC, and within weeks, I discovered what that new assignment meant was that I would be traveling 6 to 8 weeks at a chunk, 4 times a year, internationally, to work on this work. And I said, I'm over 40 years old now, and I have this little baby at home. And there is not a chance that I am going to give up raising her. And so, again, it's a choice that I made. Other people do it differently. I don't have any value system about that. I have a colleague who hires a nanny, and that nanny went with her everywhere she went with her children, and she continues to do her work internationally. I have a husband 11 years older than me, working full time. We're not hiring a nanny. He's certainly not taking care of the daughter. So for me, the choice then was obvious, and I resigned my LBL appointment and continued my faculty work at Berkeley. But what I mean by then making choices and being okay with those is I missed then that opportunity to go down that international climate change path. And that was an opportunity that never returned it. Okay, so what did I do? I began to do research work much more locally where I could take my child into the field with me on occasion, or I could go on day trips, etc. So, choices. And let me tell you, I, you know what, she's a freshman at UC San Diego, and I couldn't be more proud of her. So, it worked out all right. So, the whole point then about making choices is you, you know, gather what information you can, you analyze the situation, and then you got to be happy with the choice you made, and you got to move on. Okay? Another really important thing that I've learned along the way is I really think that we don't do enough on taking risks on the new books. And I wouldn't be here today if there weren't key instances in my career where people took risks on me. okay? And that starts with graduate school. Here I was at Berkeley. First of all, it wouldn't let me double major, so I had four more credits in anthropology than biology, and so I had to major in anthropology. So then I was looking for graduate school because, of course, remember, I'm young and I still want to save the world. So where was I going to go to graduate school? And, of course, at that time, that spouse was in graduate school there. So we were in Berkeley. So after floating around a lot of times, I finally, in desperation, went into the College of Natural Resources and talked to the dean for student affairs. Okay? He listened to me talk. He asked a bunch of questions. He said, come back tomorrow with your transcript. I'll use some more. So I came back the next day, showed him, gave him my transcript, my stuff. The third day, I was in graduate school in rangeland management at Berkeley, and I've never looked back from that. It was a wonderful fit. That never would have happened if this person hadn't taken a risk on the new kid. And so it's really important, I think, that we do that. In my particular case, that also happened when I got... So let me back up one second. So out of graduate school, there were... In rangeland ecology and management in the country, there were 10 faculty positions open during that time period that I was looking for jobs, being just nearly completing my PhD. Okay? I didn't get interviewed for one of them. I mean, you talk about a woman from Berkeley who wears cowboy boots or Birkenstock in range management that didn't have a single woman faculty member in the country. I didn't even get an interview. Okay? So the Forest Service, who admittedly was under consent decree, so you know what those are, right? They were actively recruiting me out of graduate school, and I did go and work for the Forest Service in Region 5, which is California and Hawaii, for 6 years. Again, it was a Forest Service person who came over, who took a chance, who recruited me, and I was hired, and I don't know if you're familiar with the federal GS grades, but usually a new person out of school get them 9-11 type of job. If you're really lucky, you're finally a 12 and then you're a 13 or a 14. Well, I got hired as 11 and the next year promoted to a 12 and the next year promoted to a 13. And the next year I was supposed to go to Washington, D.C. so I could come back out as a forest supervisor. But guess what? I met David in the Forest Service, and again, it was a choice. Do I want to go to D.C. and do that, or do I want to marry David and stay here? So I chose to marry David. And at that time then, I also, 6 years, this is a six-year period now, I started applying for faculty positions again because there was a part of me that loved doing administrative leadership work, but the other part of me needed to prove myself as a scientist, okay, for all the work that I had put into that. So a faculty position opened at Berkeley. I applied for that position, and 6 years later, I got offered the faculty position at Berkeley. So that was 1986. So when I came up for tenure 6 years later, so there was some dispute over my tenure. So again, taking the risk on the new folks. The provost took a look at my case that had come up through the department, through the college, to the provost, and the next thing I knew, the college and the department had not supported my case for tenure. And I was called into the provost's office, okay, and there was the chair of the department and the chair of the ad hoc committee. And the provost told the folks that he thought that this was the worst written case he had ever seen, that all the data were very obvious there, and he wanted to see the case rewritten and resubmitted to him because he was not going to cash in a chip, as you were, to override the departmental review. But it was clearly apparent to him that the departmental review needed to be rethought based on the materials in the case. I was told later that this was a first that had ever happened that anybody knew of there for a department at Berkeley. And sure enough, a few months later, without anything done on my part or any other material submitted or anything done, I got a letter congratulating me and welcoming me to the Berkeley faculty as a tenured professor. So I do have both those letters in my file. We don't want you, thank you very much, bye. And boy, you are the best thing since sliced bread, and we are happy you are here. Now, some of you might be thinking, wow, maybe she scoots by on all this stuff. Or maybe, in fact, there's just a number of things that many of us have had to go through in this profession. So, take risks on the new folks. Sometimes, in fact, I bet many of the times, certainly have for me personally, but also for the risks that I've taken on other new folks, it's worked out pretty well. So, you know, to be the best you can be, Debbie Ogley isn't in the room. Some of these things came out of her talk from 2009, and also come out of that whole, I don't know if you've seen it, this 16 harsh truths. I think all of us need to look at this once in a while, but they include things like you will make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, and we just have to admit that and try to do the best we can. Another one is not everyone will like you, and no matter how much we wish that wasn't true, it is indeed, it is true. Not everyone will like you. And you know what? Those are not the people you put on the bus with you. You might talk to them, but you don't put them on the bus. You can't change the past. We all know that. That we can't change the best. We all got to work hard. And I think really important in terms of being the best we can be is you really have to, in my opinion, and this is what I try to do, you have to have a vision that's bigger than just you. You know, it's easy in many ways to stay and be a faculty member at Berkeley with my own lab and my own graduate students who love me, of course, that's why I would have them, right? And do my own research, get my own grants, write my own papers, and live in my world like that. In many ways, it's much harder to have a bigger vision about this incredible university and what we could do collectively together that meets all our teaching and research and public service missions of this university. So I like to keep it in mind that it's better from my perspective, and again, this is my perspective, it's better to have a vision about what you're doing that's bigger than just you. And when you think about that in terms of what is now being called the me generation, I mean, we certainly see a lot of that where and we certainly see that a lot in these current budget times of what's in it for me, what's in it for my unit. I'm not playing unless I benefit. You know, sometimes you just got to think 5 years down the road. Where is it we're going? What do we want to look like? How are we going to get there? And we got to focus on that. You know, on the organization is bigger than us. We got to think about that, too, in terms of looking to the future for our family, for our kids. You know, we just, for me, that's always been a big part of the VAC's core values. So I guess I'd like to end with a story or a little vignette that's really been an epiphany to me in recent times, which is that last little bullet point about we don't have to put up with the bullies. And what do I mean by bullies? I think, and I put at the bottom of the page, two books that I have recently read. I'd be glad to pass these around. Very, very interesting food for thought. And this one by Robert Sutton, who is a Stanford professor. So it's not like he's a lightweight or anything. He has a very provocative title, The No Asshole Rule. And he, as any scientist would, very carefully defines what he means by an asshole. So all of us, of course, think, asshole, you know? We do think that often. And he has this very provocative title on purpose, obviously. He wants to sell books in addition to getting people to read the book. But a bully, or in this case, using that term, asshole, is a person that consistently demeans others. It's mean-spirited people who do damage to the victim, the bystanders, and the organization as a whole by their behaviors, by their repeated behaviors. And all of us, I think, know people that we have worked with or who have been our bosses or have been influenced us or affected us in some way. And what do we do about that? Oftentimes we're really emotionally hurt or don't know what to do, or we try to avoid that person at all costs. And, of course, I have many little stories about that, which I will only share one with you, out of the many growing up through graduate school and professorial ranks at Berkeley, because I have incredibly fabulous colleagues there. But, as you know, faculty tend to be rewarded by their own achievements. So they tend to be very self-centered. Faculty tend to be. They're not totally across the board. But faculty are taught very early that if you don't pat yourself on the back, no one else is going to do it for you. And so we engender that culture of faculty being the top rung of the ladder and faculty patting themselves on the back so they get promotions and get awards and, you know, all that other good stuff that we do. But it also tends to overinflate egos, as you can imagine. And one story that brought this home to me as a young professor, so I was, as all young professors, you're assigned to be the undergraduate advisor. And you're also assigned to be graduate advisor, and you get to advise all these students as a new professor where you're just trying to figure out what in the world you're doing, and you're advising all these young folks. Well, I had a group of students, graduate students, who a pattern emerged about a male professor that they were really afraid of. They were being harassed by. They had other allegations that they were, as I listened to them, and this pattern developed over time with these multiple different young women, and I would talk to them about things that they might do, like it gets down to change professors. you know, change professors. You don't have to stay with this person. And then they would cry or be upset and say, you know, my whole career is going to be based on this person. I won't get a job. I have to stay. You know, whatever all those excuses were that they put up with this egregious behavior. So I finally, you know, untenured young woman professor, first woman in the department, you know, first woman faculty member in range management in the country. And so I go in to my colleague, the barber chair, and I say, you know, none of these young women are willing to sign on the line that these things are happening. They're afraid for their future. But this pattern is happening, and it's been happening over and over again over many months from many different people, so the pattern is there. Will you help me do something to help these young women? So he listened very politely. Okay, he said he was going to think about it. Okay. So I was called in about 2 weeks later to the chair's office, and I go into the chair's office, and he's got his little table there, and who's sitting there but the faculty person that has these allegations. I just think, oh, my God, what is going to happen here? And I'm asked to sit down, and the chair says, you know, I asked you to come, Barbara, because I want you to talk to so-and-so and work out your differences. Oh. And if I had differences with this person. So I said, well, these things have been happening. I didn't use the students' names, though it was clearly he would know who the students were. And he just sat at the end of the chair with a smile on his face. He leaned back in the chair, put his hands behind his head like this, got a big smile on his face. He said, well, you know what? I can't help it if they think I'm God. I didn't even know what to say. I think that I blurted out, you got to be kidding. And that was the end of the meeting. I mean, that was the end. And what did I do? I got up, I went to our MSO, and I said, I have to put a note in my case file, which I wrote, this individual may never review my case or anything to do with my merits and promotion ever, which is my right as a faculty member, and put it in my case, and that was the end of it. And those women eventually left. They eventually didn't finish graduate school, and yet at that period in time, in that period, I was relatively ineffectual and powerless to do anything about that. And so that, I certainly, where I am now, and working very hard to make sure if I know about any of those things, to find out about any of those things, that I'm not going to put up with those kind of bullies. And you know what? That's what this book is about. If you don't have to, and if you get into positions of authority and power, then every one of us can do what we can do to make sure that those kind of people, that doesn't happen. So that's what I mean with you don't have to put up with the bullies. And we should all take every opportunity that we can to minimize that. Not minimize it, eliminate it. Not minimize, eliminate. Eliminate. That's why this is great.
It has this delete button on the calendar. Delete those kinds of attitudes, because this university and this place is so incredible. It's so incredible. There's such a brain trust and such incredible colleagues and people at all different levels. We need
all the people I work with feel that. And that's what makes, for me, coming to work every day such a pleasure, is working with the incredible people that we do have to work with to tolerate. So thank you.
About your Nobel experience?
You know, what I can share about that is that, so I did that for 3 years, worked on the IPCC. It was an incredible experience, working internationally, working with all these governments. I got to sit up and have to defend the chapter that I was the lead author on in front at the UN in Geneva, with all of the governments of the world with their headphones on, talking in different languages with translators, and having to respond to questions from them about why did I write this, or why is this in there, and why is that. Incredible experience, you know, to be up on the stage with 130 countries quizzing you like a PhD. So, and then like I said, I did the LBL, and then I made a choice. So I didn't work internationally after that. So here then, that was in IPCC 2. But we knew clear back in the early 90s that climate change wasn't really a big issue. But the early 90s. So one day, this package came to my house in 2007. This package came to my house, opened this package, and inside there, many of you have maybe seen it, or it's in my, if you come by the 10th floor, you can see it in my office, opened up that package, and there was a Nobel Prize certificate signed by the Nobel Prize Committee, and acknowledging those of us that were lead authors on chapters that worked from IPCC 1 through, it's now up to 5, that it may be working on 6. And it was incredible. I mean, I got to say, it was, I was just absolutely stunned. And to be acknowledged for work that I had done 15 years before. And so it was wonderful. Berkeley doesn't acknowledge shared Nobel Prizes. So only...
No parking space.
No parking space. No even acknowledgement in the list of that. So that's part of what I mean, too, by recognizing and knowing that the way the organization operates is not always how you like to see us operate. So.
Any other questions?
Well, thank you very much. And we have a bouquet of flowers.
Oh,
for you.
So much.
I could put next to that.
Yeah, thank you so much. And seriously, I am very open to talking with different folks, and I have to thank you so much. Anytime, we're on the 10th floor. Most of this group right here is on the 10th floor. And be happy to talk to you. And remember, on First Friday, get cowboy boots, wear jeans. You know, it's okay. You can do that. You can still be professional. And still, in fact, when I go next week after next, go down to the citrus tasting field day, where we'll have 350 varieties of citrus displayed, and all the farmers who grow citrus in the state will be there at Linco to taste these varieties, to choose which ones they're going to plant for the future. Then this is how I dress. Right? I do dress up, because otherwise, you know, you can't be overdressed. So I have to do this.
much for inviting me.